to be lowered in. This was the tough part. I knew I'd never again have a friend the likes of Johnny Tivio, and I couldn't bring myself to cover him with earth. I'd had enough. Our veterinarian volunteered to carry on while I went up to the house and crawled underneath the covers. The plaque on his gravestone reads, Johnny Tivio, April 24, 1956 to April 24, 1981. Known to all as the greatest all-round working horse ever to enter the arena. He died on his 25th birthday. I was walking up the steep southern slope toward the house when I took, as they say in the horse world, a bad step. My lower back suddenly locked and my legs gave out on me. I was on the ground and helpless, unable to move the lower half of my body. All sensation ceased to exist. I conjured Crawford Hall lying in traction in his hospital bed. Now, 7 years later, it was my turn. I pulled myself up the slope with my arms in excruciating pain. Stunt riding, football, team roping, calf roping, bull riding, bulldogging. All that impact on my spinal column had ruptured the discs, and I was about to know the cost. I was 46 years old. A doctor declared me too critically injured to move to the hospital. He wanted to stabilize me first and to win back the feeling in my legs. He arranged for a delivery of a rack, truly an instrument of torture, and for 30 days I was strung out on this device like a rabbit on a spit. I'm as strongly opposed as anyone could imagine to the indiscriminate use of mind-altering drugs. But doctor-administered morphine is truly a miracle drug for one beset by debilitating pain. I was able to function somewhat in the business management aspect of my life while being stretched on that awful rack. After a month, much of the sensation returned to my legs. During that time, I had educated myself in the world of back woes and settled on Dr. Bob Curlin as the man most likely to keep me out of a wheelchair. In a friend's motor home, I was taken to Dr. Curlin's clinic in Los Angeles. After a CAT scan, a computerized axial tomographic X-ray was taken. He and his team presented their report. They brought in a plastic model of a human spine and used it to terrify me. Dr. Curlin pointed to the model. You see here the lower back? The soft material in the core of these five discs has ruptured due to constant heavy impacts on the spine and leaked out, causing stalactites of invasive material. That's 30% of your problem. The rest is due to fractures and spurs throughout the spinal column. This is what's causing you the pain and the nerve impairment. We can get in there and clean up that stuff and remove the spurs and you'll be left with five discs which are like donuts. The soft middle sections will have been sucked out of them. I offered a hesitant, okay, but the news just got darker. Normally we find just one or two gone, but all five are ruptured in your lower back. It's going to be a long operation, and we won't find out how successful we've been until it's finished. And darker. You have very extensive damage to the spine, Monty. Forget riding. Don't even think of riding again. You won't be lifting a weight more than 40 pounds, either. You'll probably just be able to walk around under your own steam. Be happy with that, because you're on the verge of living the rest of your life in a wheelchair. For 2 or 3 days, I went through preparation. They took me off the morphine, and when the pain roared back, I roared with it. I wanted to scream, "Fix it!" every second of every minute. Then I went under the knife. 10 hours later, I woke up to see a smiling black woman in a perfect white uniform. She looked like an angel. Had I died and gone to heaven? Or was this the other place? "Okay, Mr. Roberts," she said. "Shall we visit the bathroom?" Surely she jested. "I can't move." "Oh, yes, you can. Time to sit up now." Was she aware I had only just come around from the anesthetic? She started to pull my feet out from the bed and sit me up. The pain shot through me. Iron bolts were being driven into my back by Satan himself. She held my shoulders, but every time she let go, my body would flop, as if a new hinge had been inserted somewhere in my middle. "Wow," she said admiringly. They must have done a good job on you. Later they hung me in a wheeled contraption that suspended me in midair like a wicker chair hangs from a tree limb in a garden. I was in a sorry state. The video of the operation was one of the more grotesque movies I've seen. The surgeons looked like a gang of carpenters with muscular forearms arriving for work. Their toolboxes were filled with hammers and chisels. After cutting through and peeling back muscles and soft tissue, they went at my back like they were mending a broken house. Following my recovery, they sent me home and told me to keep moving, to walk a minute or two more each day. I was in a wheelchair for 12 days, then on crutches for several months. I have a scar down the middle of my back from my bottom rib to my tailbone, and my lower right leg is virtually dead. You could stub a cigarette out on it. Dr. Curlin and his gang of carpenters did a better job than he thought was possible. I can walk fine, and I can ride. The horse I'd ride, and still ride, is a registered quarter horse gelding, a bay. He is a white pastern on his near hind leg and a white irregular star between the eyes with a strip that runs down to his muzzle. It forms an inverted question mark, which seems apt for this horse. Dooley was a cull from the Greg Ward ranch, a throwaway horse whom no one would buy. He had crooked hind legs 6 inches shorter than they should have been, pigeon-toed feet, and was bow-legged behind. Greg and I treated him as an experiment. We tied the reins to his saddle horn and let him have his way. He still has his way. He's jealous and possessive of me, and he's still funny-looking. But he's also become a superb horse. He's 14 hands, 3 inches high, and weighs 1,200 pounds. A solid guy, this Dooley. His name refers to a type of pickup truck, called a Dooley, with a beefed-up rear end and twin tires at the back. We use them to haul horse trailers. Such trucks look massively broad and strong if you stand behind them, and that's how Dooley looks. His rear quarters are like two small hills jammed together, and the power they give him is mind-boggling. He's a turbocharged twin-engine type of rocket horse, with a balance and coordination now bred into the breed. There's no way he can replace Brownie or Johnny Tivio. But Dooley's a natural successor to them, both in terms of my affection for him and in his achievements. He, too, is a world-class championship-winning animal in his own right. From my first day with Dooley, I felt he was at heart a near-perfect working animal. After join-up, Dooley bonded with me very strongly, and like Johnny Tivio, he'll follow me around the farm without any headgear on. I can wander up to the promontory that overlooks the farm, and he'll walk alongside as if there were an invisible thread connecting us. He's been schooled from start to finish using only the methods described in this book. Now 7, he's in the prime of life. The understanding between us is mature and well-founded. I have not so much trained him as created an environment in which he has wanted to learn. I've never pulled at his mouth, ever. In fact, I could use cotton thread instead of leather reins. Yet on a totally loose rein, he'll slide to a blinding halt from a full gallop just hearing a single word, whoa, and at the same time feeling my weight settle back in the saddle. Again on a loose rein, he'll spin like a top, just feeling the gossamer weight of the rein against his neck and a slight pressure applied to the inside leg. Dooley has an immense heart, which is just as well because to train him using these experimental methods takes patience and hard work from both of us. However, having learned from my experiences with Brownie and Fancy Heels, among hundreds of others, I've taken care not to dull his appetite for work by repetition or excess. It's been essential to our progress together that he remain fresh and keen. The crazy horse is almost never born, but made. And it pains me to hear the term. If we could somehow see for ourselves all the events in a horse's life that together account for his malicious behavior, we'd be astonished. Some horses will take so much, then finally take no more. Few people still think humans are born crazy, but in the world of horses, the bad seed myth endures. His sire was that way too, trainers will say of a troubled horse. They've been saying that for 6,000 years. They're wrong. Maybe 2% of horses are born bad. The rest are put on that path by people. Stories abound about truly nasty horses. Native Dancer, who sired the fleet Northern Dancer, would pick up a groom by the teeth and toss him in the air like a stick. He'd haul riders off his back by their boots. I once read that his groom, who loved him like a son, freely admitted that had it not been for careful handling, Native Dancer would have killed someone. In his paddock, the horse would see the groom and, in his own time, come to the gate to be led away. If the groom entered the paddock before that moment, the stallion would run at him with murderous intent. Flag Is Up Farms has also had its share of stallions requiring great vigilance, but none so dangerous as a thoroughbred called Intisar. He was by Roberto out of strip poker, as fine a pedigree as you can imagine. It made him a half-brother to the champion Landoluce. He was purchased as a yearling at Keeneland in 1979 for $250,000 by Buckram Oak Farm and sent to France to race. He was a good winner early on, but then he was injured and offered for sale at the reduced price of $220,000. The horse struck me as a good prospect for syndication, so along with partners Albert A. Katz and Ronald Semler, we bought him to put together a syndicate for breeding. He was a handsome, proud stallion, a blood bay horse, red tones with black mane and tail. Intisar was tall, strong, and muscled, especially through the neck and shoulders. In California, we offered him at $16,000 a share, which is like arranging timeshare leases on his capacity as a father. The 25 shares sold within 2 weeks, yielding the partners a gross of $400,000, which meant we were already $180,000 to the good and had kept back 5 shares each to be used on our own mares. This was a good piece of business. Intisar started covering mares in 1983 and bred without incident for the first half of the season. Then came reports that he was being aggressive with his handlers. I spent time watching him. If his handlers took him to the breeding room, he covered his mare and all was well. If, on the other hand, they turned toward his paddock instead of the breeding barn, he became aggressive. Since the aggression seemed to be a function of his sexuality, I brought his handlers a metal noseband stallion halter to use on him, which seemed to solve the problem for a day or two. Then it recurred in the breeding room, where he had previously been willing and cooperative, if a touch overenthusiastic. At the same time, rumors reached me that a young man on our night staff had taken it upon himself to school in Tisar. I'm sure he had good intentions, but he had likely mistreated the stallion, at least in the opinion of the horse. Intisar became dangerous, and he bit 2 men quite badly. I huddled with Dr. Van Snow, our resident veterinarian, and his assistant, the breeding room staff, and Darrell Skelton, who was handling the stallions. Our solution was to create a safety zone around the stallion. 2 8-foot staves, 1.5-inch thick doweling, attached to Intisar's halter would keep his handlers at a distance. They bred 2 or 3 mares that way. Intisar was happy and didn't object to this careful handling procedure. He even seemed proud of it. The next time a romantic appointment was booked for him, I once again came down to observe and offer help if necessary. We brought a mare into the breeding room, cleaned under her tail with soap and water, bandaged her tail in gauze, all precautions to minimize infections and injuries to both stallion and mare, and had her standing in the center of the room. 2 men put the wooden staves on Intisar and led him toward the breeding room where the mare waited in full heat and well let down, meaning that she was receptive to the stallion. The 2 men led Intisar through the large door in the center of this 40-foot square room. 6 feet into the room, he planted himself, lordly looking the situation over. In the room were 7 people. 2 men on the staves, 1 man with the mare, the veterinarian, his assistant, Darrell Skelton, and myself. I closed the door behind the stallion, and Darrell and I walked over to join Dr. Snow. Intisar stood stock still, just looking at the mare and around the room. Without warning, he struck out his left front foot. reaching over the top of the stave and slapping it out of the man's hand and onto the floor. The weight of his body snapped the doweling in two. The man on that side was left holding one broken portion, while the jagged other half hung dangerously from the stallion's halter. A second later, Intisar reached up with his other foot and, without breaking it, slapped the stave out of the other man's hand. The horse was deadly accurate. No question, this was a calculated move. Moving fast, he attacked the mare with his mouth wide open. He sank his teeth into her left flank, ripping at it like a wolf would a rabbit. When his shoulder struck her, she fell heavily to the floor, landing on her side. The man holding the mare fled for his life. With a hunk of her hide in his mouth, Intisar was now kneeling over the mare, squealing and pawing. The noise in that room was deafening, the excitement and enormous power of it overwhelming. My time in the rodeo arena with bulldogging and bronc and bull riding had given me the greatest schooling I know to cope with tense and dangerous situations, but it was little use to me now. I moved to my right. Intisar had knocked the mare down near the south wall, and as I moved to the corner, he wheeled and took a run at me. I ran back along the wall to gain the protection of the examination chute. Dr. Snow, who had moved along with me, held a shavings rake in his hand. His intention was to protect the mare and the rest of us by holding the stallion at bay with a rake. Intisar went straight for him and ran into the end of the rake as if it were made of paper mache. When Dr. Snow fled into the lab in the northwest corner, he crashed into his assistant standing in the doorway, and both fell into the lab, in safety. Darrell and I both ended up in the examination chute. I never felt more vulnerable and less in charge. The two men on the staves had sought refuge outside the north door, which was open a foot, and I'm sure they were prepared to close it if the horse came that way. The man who had been holding the mare stood outside the south door, also open a foot. Having terrorized us all, Intisar now faced the lab, weaving back and forth as if to say, "I control you all. I'm in charge now." He turned slowly and walked on the tips of his toes with his tail stuck out and his neck arched high. It was a beautiful, terrifying sight. He went straight to the mare, who was still lying on the floor, and he stood over her flank. He pawed and squealed several times, as a stallion does when courting a mare, and the mare slowly got to her feet. Blood dripped onto the floor from the large gash on her flank. Intisar rooted at that flank with his nose a few times, and was fully erect. Incredibly, the mare lifted her tail to display her receptivity. He mounted her, and every one of us there stood frozen and watched in fascination. It was a primal, powerful experience. After covering the mare, Intisar walked slowly to the north door. He stopped there, the aggression clearly gone. The men outside slowly opened the door and walked him down the alleyway to his stall. He went quiet as a lamb. As Dr. Snow, Darrell, and I walked along behind him, the doctor shook his head. "I'm going to carry my pistol with me from now on, and if he ever does anything like that again, he'll have to die. I'm not going to risk losing somebody's life." I agreed. Something dramatic had to be done before someone was killed. We concluded that the horse was perhaps overfed and underworked. If he was ridden in the hills, really put to work, maybe we could change his attitude. Darrell offered to ride him each day, but Dr. Snow and I insisted that one of us be around to offer help should something go wrong. On the day set aside to try this new strategy, we took Intisar to a place on the farm with strong corrals and cattle handling facilities, a loading chute and a squeeze gate. Once in the gate, we would get his tack on and take him for a ride. In the stall, Darrell managed to get a shank on Intisar and lead him toward the corrals. Halfway there, the horse spotted a mare in a field a quarter mile away and started to play up. Darrell tried to soothe him, but the horse made a move indicating he was going to attack him. We all stood in a small half-acre area while Intisar made some very aggressive gestures. Moments later, Darrell lost control of the shank and Intisar was loose. We managed to avoid being attacked, but if he spotted one of us, even from a distance of 200 or 300 yards, he'd go for us. He was really angry, and we ran around like Keystone cops. Eventually, we set some gates to trap him near the heavy-duty cattle apparatus. Darrell was able to get him in the squeeze, and we swung the gate over to him until he stood in an area 12 feet long and 3 feet wide. When we closed the gate to move him over, he kicked it and then held his near hind leg off the ground for about 20 seconds. We held our breath, thinking he had broken his leg. The kick was that fierce. Then he put his leg down and stood on it as normal. There was just a bit of hair off, about mid-shaft on the cannon bone. Once he was in there, Darrell tacked him up and mounted him. He took him up a hill where they could ride for about 15 miles with no gates to open, and they were gone for about 3 hours. When he returned, he rode him into the stallion round pen, took his saddle off, and led him to the wash rack to give him a bath. Intisar was fine. He looked a picture of health, a fine example of a stallion in the prime of his life. You could have sold him to a schoolgirl, unless her father noticed that iron-hard, disinterested look in his eye. We were all pleased, and Darrell started a program of riding the horse each day. On about the fifth day, Dr. Snow agreed that Intisar was calm enough now for us to get an X-ray of that still slightly sore hind leg. When this revealed a significant fracture of the cannon bone, we faced a dilemma. How long could Darrell ride him before the exercise became cruel? Darrell cut his work right down. On the second day, when Darrell came back to the round pen and took off his saddle, Intisar attacked him. That was the last straw. In the normal course of events, a horse with a history like this one would be destroyed. Around the world, many stallions have been killed for less. I couldn't bear to have him killed, however. It was dangerous even to try helping him, but we'd have one last go at saving his life. In the end, I devised a complex system of gates, small enclosures, and squeeze chutes that would allow Intisar to be groomed, shod, clipped, bathed, and exercised, and have his stable cleaned and serviced, all without having anyone in the enclosure with him. He could also breed a mare without having anyone in the enclosure as well. He was bred in this fashion for 12 years without any injury to a mare, himself, or anyone working with him. We now have another remedial stallion, Court Dance, by Northern Dancer, who stands in the same facility. Court Dance was owned by Robert Sangster and John Manier when he was sent to our farm. They hoped I could sort out his problems so they could sell him, but I quickly learned that he was another dangerous stallion beyond fixing, even beyond transporting or handling. For the past 3 years, he has been breeding here under the same system we used with Intisar, and he's getting along very well. I always prefer to come to an understanding with a horse through communication and dialogue, but that wasn't possible with these two stallions. From the accounts I've read about violent stallions, such as Ribot and Graustark, and even Intisar's sire, Roberto, I have no doubt that there exists a significant number of incurably aggressive stallions. On a scale of 1 to 10, Intisar was a 9.9. He was intelligent and cunning, and he wanted to harm people. Something in his environment had turned him mean, and he had no intention of listening to anyone. Beauty may well be in the eye of the beholder, but while conformation is in part subjective, there are roots of realism when assessing the qualities of the equine athlete. And if, during an 18-year career buying and selling thoroughbreds, I showed that I had an eye for a horse, that owes something to sculpture. Early in the 1970s, when Pat took up painting and equine sculpture, she began by studying horse anatomy. You have to know the inside of a horse before you can begin to capture the outside, and I tried to help Pat as best I could. I recall one time watching one of her teachers sketching horses by one of the paddocks. He was using a triangle to help maintain correct proportions. To get a sense of what I saw that day, imagine a horse seen from the side, and over that horse lay a triangle, its apex sitting as high as the horse's head and midway between head and tail. From that high point, one line angled down at 45 degrees through the shoulder, another angled down at 45 degrees through the hip, and the baseline ran horizontally through both knees and hocks. In a well-balanced horse, the apex is right in the middle. In a thoroughbred racehorse, the two sides of the triangle are equal, but the baseline is considerably longer. Using triangles to judge conformation is so simple, yet so profound. Pat still works in bronze, and it's rare not to have one of her equine sculptures taking shape in our kitchen. And when I look on as she subtly molds and adjusts, I think of that day by the paddock when an artist's sketch reduced the tangled business of horse conformation to a bit of basic geometry. From the mid-1970s until 1989, sometimes with partners, I bought yearling thoroughbreds at one public auction in Kentucky, say, and then sold them as two-year-olds at another public auction, perhaps in California. It's called pinhooking, an awful name for a demanding and risky test of horsemanship, in which an eye for conformation is critical. The term pinhooking, it said, comes from England, where a woman whose husband bought and sold young horses likened it to crocheting. You reach in and pinhook an animal, then put him back in. A lot can go wrong. If you select badly, if the horse gets injured, if the market declines, the pinhooker can be pricked. The aim, of course, is to sell the horse for a lot more than you paid. My aim always was to get twice for a horse what I spent, and between 1973 and 1990 I came remarkably close. Pat and I purchased 195 yearling thoroughbreds for $6.9 million and sold them for $13.3 million, a return on investment of 43%. Every young racehorse we purchased was also sold, a rare accomplishment in a business where many operations lose 5 to 10% of yearlings for one reason or another. The numbers are impressive. 82% of the horses we sold during those 18 years would start in races, and of that number, 79% were winners, 13% of them in highly competitive stakes races. Consigners, or sellers of horses, are ranked, and during our years in the business, Pat and I were ranked first 10 times, second 3 times, and third 3 times. For 16 of 18 years, then, we were in the top 3. You'll likely sell well if you buy well, but that presumes an intimate knowledge of pedigrees and smart bids at the sales ring. America still uses the old tobacco auctioning system of fast chatter. It took me years to master its tricks and psychology. Shipping horses is another major challenge. For me especially, since 2,500 miles separated the auction ring and my training grounds. Conditioning, foot care, nutrition, marketing, and promotion all matter. And the trainer who falls down in just one category will suffer in the long run. A sleek, impeccably groomed young thoroughbred is as graceful and desirable as any animal on the planet. But letting him use his gift of speed while also keeping him sound and healthy, and starting him so he remains keen to work, there's art in that. And the record of Pat and Monty Roberts' agents is unmatched. In Kentucky in the mid-1970s, I bought a registered thoroughbred yearling stallion, 14 hands 2 inches high, less than 900 pounds in weight, by Hoist the Flag out of Princess Pout. A bay horse with 2 rear white pasterns, he was in horrible condition and not many people gave him a second glance. Precisely because he was so thin, I could see that he had the best skeletal balance of any thoroughbred I had ever seen. And history would suggest I was right. 10 years later, in 1984, I attended a thoroughbred symposium held by Dr. Michael Osborne, a world authority on thoroughbred conformation. Toward the end of his lecture, he flashed a silhouette of a thoroughbred onto the overhead projector. "This animal," he said, "is perhaps the most perfectly constructed thoroughbred I've ever studied." He gazed out at his audience. "Can anyone name this horse by any chance?" I raised my hand. "Aha," said Dr. Osborne. "How did you identify your horse in silhouette, Monty?" I said, "You have your system of circles. You test to see if certain anatomical features meet or fail to meet the various points on the circle." "That's correct." "Well, I have a similar system involving a triangle." Dr. Osborne invited me to the overhead projector to explain. "My triangle," I said, "seeks to discover the balance between the two major skeletal structures in a horse, the pelvis and the shoulders. These two engines propel the horse over the ground, and their engineering determines the efficiency with which the rest of the body responds to brain signals. Dr. Osborne finished by saying, "For those of you still in the dark, this horse was owned by Mr. Roberts very early on in his life. That horse, twice the winner of the Arc de Triomphe, is alleged." My mother had not long to live, and knew it, when she set about trying to reconcile her husband and her elder son. Intuitively, she hoped that through horses we might connect. My parents' visits by this time, 1986, had become rare and short. Suddenly they were coming to the farm for an entire week. It was clear to me that my mother's cancer had gotten worse, and that this visit was both a final farewell and a peace mission. She engineered and cajoled, pushed and prodded. She arranged for my father to watch me work with horses in the round pen, ensured he had a stool to sit on, made it so he couldn't wriggle free. She came close to telling him he had to sit there and take note of what I was doing and acknowledge that it was working. On the day my father sat down, finally, to watch me start a raw horse, he was well into his 70s. I was no longer desperate for his approval, though I was still a son who would have welcomed his father's belated blessing. I was also a man in his 50s who had by this time started more than 6,500 horses. Apart from all the working horses, I had trained thoroughbreds who had gone on to win major stakes races all over the world. The irony of that day was not lost on me. When I began to learn the language of horses at the age of 7, my father was the one man I first wanted to impress with it. And when he turned so savagely on me, and so furiously rejected my ideas, I determined he would never see me gentle a horse. No one would. The round corral had been a feature of European farming and Western ranching for centuries, but the one I designed was built with solid walls, partly to keep the horse's focus on me, and partly to keep out a world of disinterest and rejection. I remember too vividly the scornful words of Ray Hackworth after seeing me gentle a horse. "That was a fluke. You're wrong to go against your father." I had spent my life going against my father, and now finally, because my mother had made it her dying wish, he'd see where it had taken me. Only recently had I added to the pen the skirt-like structure that let people see me converse with horses. This day I'd start a gorgeous young chestnut filly, a horse whose character I would have to discover. I could see immediately that she was a fast type, quick to respond, nervous, but intelligent. I stood in the middle of the ring and coiled my light sash line. Moving slowly, I squared my body to hers, lifting up my arms a touch and opening my fingers. I locked my eye onto her eye. The result was dramatic. She fled to the perimeter of the round pen, running counterclockwise. "Okay, Dad," I called. "I'm going to explain the sequence of events so you can understand what's happening." I hardly needed the sash line to keep this filly going comfortably. I could control her speed by choosing where to look at her. If I kept my eyes on her eyes, I could increase the speed of her flight from me. If I moved my gaze back to her shoulder, she slowed. At all times, I kept my body squared to hers. "The first thing I'm looking for is that inside ear to lock on to me," I called to my father, who sat still as a post on his stool. "It'll happen maybe within a minute." The words were hardly out of my mouth when the filly's ear settled on me. "Of course she's going to listen out for you," my father called out. "It's more than listening out for me. She's keeping the ear on me as a mark of respect. She's allowing me some importance here." I pitched the sash line ahead of her, causing her to turn sharply and flee in the opposite direction. Despite the switch, the ear nearest me was turned in my direction, constantly. She settled back to a steady trot. After another revolution of the round pen, I said, "Next you'll see another mark of respect she'll want to offer me. You'll see her licking and chewing. You'll see her tongue come through her teeth, then she'll pull it back and demonstrate a chewing action." Sure enough, she began to lick and chew. "There it is. She's saying that she's a herbivore, that if she can be allowed to eat safely, if she can be allowed to stop running away, then we can come to an arrangement. We can settle our respective positions, live and let live. Let's talk." We were now 5 minutes into the starting procedure, and I explained to my father the final signal before join-up. "I'm looking for her to drop her head, to run along with her nose a couple of inches from the ground." Within a few minutes, the filly was trotting around, blowing at the sand in front of her feet, her ear still on me. "She's telling me it's okay, she can trust me." Turning my shoulders to a point slightly beyond the filly, I allowed my eyes to trail there, too. Immediately, the filly stopped. I waited perfectly still, standing at an angle to her, showing my flanks and avoiding any eye contact, even out of the corner of my eye. I sensed a reluctance in her. She found it difficult to believe I knew her language, but she was forced to acknowledge that I had responded to all her signals. Join-up is always the most thrilling part of the process. Not because I ever doubt it will happen, but simply because it proves the possibility of communication between human and horse. A flight animal giving her trust to a fight animal, human and horse spanning the gap between them, always strikes me as miraculous. The moment it occurs is always fresh, always satisfying. The filly took a tentative step toward me. I wasn't looking at her, but I knew she was weighing her next move and deciding to join up with me. Moments later, she was standing next to me, her nose at my shoulder. I walked slowly in a circle to the right, then to the left. Both times she followed me. Join up with this filly was complete. "That's what I call join up," I said to my father. "How many times has that one been ridden?" my father asked doubtfully.
"Never, Dad."
"Pah." The chestnut filly waited for what would happen next on this extraordinary day when everything would change for her. As I always try to, I reminded myself that this was possibly the most nerve-wracking moment in her whole life. I called to my father. "Now I'm going to investigate the vulnerable areas to confirm that she trusts me completely." I walked to the center of the pen with the filly following me. I dropped the sash line on the ground and stood at her shoulder. "The vulnerable areas are where her predators will attack," I said aloud. Moving slowly and quietly, I ran my hands over her withers and her neck. "The big cats will jump up here, clawing into the back of a horse, biting into the top of the neck in an attempt to damage the spinal cord, paralyzing the horse or causing it to fall just from their weight. If the horse is paralyzed, it's easy for the cat to finish him off. If the horse isn't paralyzed, then the cat will go to the ground with him and slip his teeth around under the neck in order to collapse the trachea and shut off his air supply. So it's important she lets me into these vulnerable areas." Next, I moved my hand slowly across her flanks and under her belly. "On every continent, one type of wild dog or another preys on horses. One in the pack grabs the tail, another hangs off her nose, but the majority head for her soft flanks, another sensitive area." She stood reasonably firm, sidestepping only once or twice. I continued until I found an absence of rejection and tension in her. Then I picked up each of her hooves, sliding my hand down from the knee or the hock over the tendon and then to the rear of the fetlock joint, before asking her to lift her feet one by one, just holding them off the ground for a second or two. "You see, she's a flight animal, and she's just allowed me to pick up her method of propulsion, her feet. She's trusting me, pretty much from top to toe now." By this point, we were about 20 minutes into the starting procedure. Hector Valadez now entered the round pen carrying a saddle pad, a bridle, and a long stirrup leather, as well as a second driving line. Hector had been sent to me by another trainer in 1969. Then 18 years old and weighing about 80 pounds, he looked as if he might make a jockey. I put him on his first horse that year, and he's been riding 8 to 12 horses a day for me ever since, save for several short periods when he worked for friends of mine. As it turned out, he wasn't motivated to be a jockey. He'd be a better father instead for his two sons. Hector has spent more time with me in the round pen than any other person. While his size kept him useful on the training track, he's probably been the first rider up on about 1,500 horses during the 30 years he's been with me. Hector positioned the equipment in the middle of the round pen, then left. The arrival of this new person in the round pen, and more alarmingly, a pile of odd-looking equipment, caused the usual consternation in the young filly. She snorted, blew at the saddle, stared hard, wandered around, and generally came to terms with it. If anything, however, the equipment heightens join-up because the perceived danger makes the horse seek her safety zone. Me. This one stood by me as I lifted the saddle onto her back, took the girth under her belly, and buckled it up the other side. "I want her to get used to the saddle for a while," I told my father, "before Hector gets on her." I stepped back from the filly and squared up to her, driving her away again. She went into flight, cantering with an odd, skewed gait as she coped with the strange new feeling of a saddle on her back. As she cantered, then trotted around the ring, I waited for the same signals. The inside ear settling on me, the licking and chewing. This time I wouldn't expect her to lower her head. She couldn't trust herself to do that with this new weight on her back. That was too much to ask so early. "Now I'm going to try a little experiment," I announced. "You'll see she has a sweet spot just there in the ring." I had noticed a particular place where she gave me her full attention. At other points around the circle, she was distracted by something. My father, the pen door, the light above. I knew from long experience that most babies, young green horses, have a sweet spot, and that it's best to wait until they're in it before trying the more subtle signs of equus. "I'm going to hold my hand across the front of my body, and when she reaches her sweet spot, I'm going to do nothing more than simply open my fingers. You'll notice her pick up speed considerably." I held my hand across in front of my chest, and when I opened my fingers, she broke into a canter. "See? That's how much she's reading me. She knows she can let a cat walk right past her, but if that cat has its claws open, she has to flee, and pretty quickly." I set her going in the opposite direction, allowing her to become familiar with the saddle, and after three or four revolutions she was asking to come back into me. I tightened her girth a notch. "Now for the bridle. Once join-up is achieved, it's pretty much of a formality. The join-up tells me she trusts me. And with horses, that's not too big a step away from her offering to work as hard as she can for me." She was now wearing her first bridle, standing there unconcerned, chewing at the bit that sat across her mouth for the first time. "Now that the bridle's on, we can long-line her." We were now 25 minutes into the procedure. I long-lined the filly in both directions. This marked the first time she had ever walked into the reins, and I wanted to get her used to them before Hector got on her back, just to give him something like a steering wheel. After the long-lining, I backed her up a step. As soon as that backward step was taken, I released the pressure on the long lines, rewarding her immediately. Then I pulled her girth tighter by a further notch, ready for Hector to ride her. Hector came into the ring and made himself known to her. He too rubbed her vulnerable areas until she was happy with his presence. He brushed her new saddle lightly with his hands. Then I lifted him onto her back and he lay across her for several moments, while I turned her head this way and that to make sure she caught sight of him draped over her middle. Carefully, slowly, Hector lifted a leg over her back and rode her for the first time. Hector walked her around the ring, not bothering with her mouth or whether she broke into a trot or anything else. The aim was simply to let her take stock of what was happening on her back. I checked my watch. "Half an hour," I called to my father. "About average." My father went off to quiz Hector, then returned to the viewing deck in his stool. Because my mother had so carefully chosen the day, I had started 10 young horses by the time darkness fell. Each time the same process repeated itself. Each time Hector was in the saddle and riding them comfortably around the ring within half an hour. No restraints, harsh words, or whips. By the end of that day, my father had seen me start more horses than he could have broken in 6 weeks. He came down from the viewing deck and we stood outside, hardly able to see each other's faces in the dusk. "What do you think of that?" "Keep doing it that way," I heard him say. "And they'll get you." Up at the house that night, my mother seemed especially anxious to know what he thought. In her mind, much hung on this. It was a question of justice for her son and a truce between the two men she loved equally. She skirted the topic for a while, then finally she asked, "So, Marvin, how'd you enjoy what you saw today?"
Fine. My mother pressed.
What do you think of it all?
My father replied, It's suicide. There'd be no end in her lifetime, or his for that matter, to the rift. My mother had hoped that with the passage of time, the changes in circumstances, our common interest in horses might at last help us connect. But the horse remained a towering symbol of the space between father and son. My mother's intestinal cancer took her away from us soon afterward, and we journeyed to Salinas for her funeral. We arrived at their house, where my father had some years ago built a block of stables and created a few paddocks. Until recently, he had given riding lessons and had still been involved with horses. Now, with the death of his wife, he was in a sorry state. He greeted us upon our arrival with the words, Come on in. Your mother will be back in a while. Pat and I looked at each other, as if to verify what we had heard him say, and then I walked inside with him. Dad, she won't be back. She died. He waited a long while and then admitted, Yeah, I suppose she did. Half an hour later, as we were leaving the house for the funeral service, my father stopped in his tracks and said, Hold on. We have to wait for Marguerite. She's not back yet. Again, I jolted him back. Dad, she's waiting for us at the funeral home. This is her funeral. Yeah, okay. By a strange coincidence, the Struve and Laporte funeral home was located four doors down from our old house in Salinas, 347 Church Street. It seemed to me now such a small neighborhood compared with what I remembered. The houses had shrunk, the road a thin strip of pavement. The funeral home was operated by Jim Laporte. In the 1940s, the whole Laporte family, including Jim, had been our riding students at the competition grounds. Now this gray-haired man, whom I remembered as my young pupil bouncing around on the back of a horse, was greeting us. As we headed inside, my father again wondered about my mother's whereabouts. Jim told us that this often happened when elderly people long together are suddenly separated. Only a few people attended my mother's funeral service at the local Catholic church. Her life had been spent entirely in the service of her husband and her children. Larry and I were concerned about how fast our father was now declining and whether he could cope. Any suggestion that he move in with us was firmly rejected. Even his doctor advised against it. My father, the doctor said, was healthy as a mule, with no desire to move anywhere. The doctor had someone to check on him regularly and to ensure that he was eating well. Larry and I set up a program of regular calls and visits. If I asked my father on the phone how he was, he'd say, Fine. Got that filly going nicely now, you know, and the Palomino colt is a good horse. Dad, you're not doing anything with those horses. I certainly am. Well, okay. After one visit, Larry called us to say that my father had stopped eating and was fading fast. I agreed to come the following day, but next morning, 42 days after my mother's death, Larry found him dead. On a hunch, Jim Laporte politely called me to say that my father's body was lying in a room at the funeral home. Did I want to see him? Jim ushered me into a small room, clean and bare but for a stand of flowers and a trestle at one end holding the coffin. The only light in the room, a soft glow, was aimed directly on my father. Jim left me alone and I walked forward to look into the coffin. Larry's words came back to me. He's shrinking to nothing in front of my eyes. My father seemed only 5 feet tall, and the flesh had almost disappeared from his bones. I'd waited for this moment most of my life. When I was 10, I knew that one day there would be a funeral, and then I could touch him. Only then. I could finally shake his hand. For most of my life, I had longed for the moment when I'd stand over my dead father. This was precisely the picture I had had. He in the wooden box, me looking down on him. Through his punishments and beatings, that image had sustained me. Cowering under his blows as a child, I knew that one day he would not be able to hurt me anymore. It was a cathartic moment. and though I've shed many tears in my life, I didn't shed one as I gazed into that coffin. The anger lived on, as if he had thrashed me yesterday, not more than 40 years earlier. He at least was relieved of whatever made him like he was. I will not forget the triggers that set him off, when I forgot one of his orders or defied him. Once he had for many hours tied up a horse's hind leg, and I could bear the horse's pain no longer. I released him, intending to retie the ropes later, but when my father returned home earlier than I expected and saw what I had done, he chased me around the barn and flung me from a haystack. Another bloodied skull. Another trip to Dr. Murphy. I knew the triggers that led to violence. I, too, have felt that anger rise in me. Felt the urge to strike out at someone in my family. But I put my grip on that anger. I swore that this man in the box would be the last link in the chain of violence and anger aimed as much at humans as at horses. What stopped me, what still stops me, was the man my father killed. At that moment in the Golden Dragon Saloon, I had sworn I would not be cast in my father's image. My father's death put a final seal on that pact with myself. After leaving the funeral home, I was moved to drive to Chinatown and find the bar where all those years ago I had watched my father's cruel arrest of the black man. It was still a downtrodden area, and now there were drug addicts lying around as well, which was not the case in 1943. The Golden Dragon wasn't where it should have been. As I searched, a police car swung by and parked right behind me. My Lincoln looked out of place in this area. The officer carefully approached the passenger side window, and I lowered it so he could speak.
You're lost, right?
No, I'm not lost. I'm back here to visit. It's more than 40 years since I last sat in this spot. Because I hadn't immediately asked for his help in navigating my way out of this dangerous neighborhood, he perhaps suspected I had come to buy drugs, and his manner became more guarded.
Oh, yeah?
I went on. There used to be a saloon here called the Golden Dragon. You know what happened to it?
It was torn down a year ago, maybe.
My father made an arrest in there 40 years ago. It was a bad night. I came by just to remember it. The officer brightened.
Your father was a policeman?
For 12 years, as it turned out. He retired from the force quite a few years ago now, though.
What was his name?
Marvin Roberts.
Oh, yeah. There's a big funeral for him tomorrow. A lot of officers are going to that.
He was right. At my father's service the following day, an enormous contingent of Salinas policemen added to an already packed church. At my mother's funeral only 6 weeks earlier, the church had been virtually empty. One day a ghost called me on the phone. It's Lyman Fowler here. I could do no more than echo his own name back to him, but with an exclamation mark at the end of it. I wonder if you remember, but I used to teach you in high school.
Of course I do.
You might also remember I had you do a paper.
I remember it distinctly.
I'm retired now, as you can imagine, but I have a favor to ask of you. I'm the social director of my church group, and every year we try to go somewhere pretty, somewhere civilized. No muggings or any of that, because we're quite a geriatric group, as you might expect.
What can I do for you?
I thought it might be possible to bring them out to have a look at your place. We wouldn't be any trouble. We'd only take up an hour or two of your time. But we've read about you in the papers, of course, and it occurred to me that it might be possible. After agreeing on a time for the tour, I put the phone down and shook my head in disbelief. I remembered Mr. Fowler all right, and that Life's Ambition project with the big red F written across it. He was coming to visit the establishment that bore quite a resemblance to the plans I had submitted in that paper, plans he had initially rejected as impossibly extravagant. On that perfect summer's day when the bus arrived at Flag Is Up Farms, Mr. Fowler, he would always be Mr. Fowler to me, was the first to step out. Despite his age, He didn't stoop. He was still very tall, still smartly dressed, and with the same olive complexion and prominent eyes that I remembered. His hair had turned completely white, and his face was lined. Otherwise, it was the same man. He offered me a long, graceful hand and spoke in his precise way. "Monty, hello." Then he kept coming and gave me a heartfelt embrace, which seemed unlike him. People were filing off the bus and now stood in a semicircle, 50 seniors looking expectantly at me. Lyman Fowler made his introductory speech. "Ladies and gentlemen, this is Monty Roberts, whom I've told you about, and he's kindly offered to show us his establishment, Flag Is Up Farms." Given the advanced years of many of these people, much of the tour had to be conducted from the bus. Like a proper tour guide, I used the bus's microphone to explain the sights as we drove around. My guests had all lived in agricultural communities, so were genuinely interested in the planning of the farm. I had arranged for some horses to be on the training track. Parked alongside, we could watch the thoroughbreds breeze by. Lastly, we drove up the slope to the house, where everyone came inside to look around. Out on the terrace, refreshments in hand, they could see the whole farm spread out below. Mr. Fowler then gave a speech I'll always remember. We stood side by side as he began. "As you all know, I taught Monty when he was a young man. However, he taught me something, and it's possibly the most valuable lesson I ever learned." He paused, then articulated a notion, almost word for word, that my mother had voiced to me almost 4 decades ago and that I had written down in a brave little note appended to the paper I returned to him. "A teacher does not have the right to put a cap on the aspirations of his students, no matter how unreal these aspirations might seem." He held out his long arm, indicating the buildings and paddocks below us. "There was a time when I told Monty that this was unattainable. Now we've all had a good look around and seen how he proved me wrong." Lyman Fowler clearly enjoyed telling this story, and I felt a great warmth toward him. Chapter 6. Dear Friends. One cloudy day in November 1977, I was riding Johnny Tivio around the farm as I often did to check on pastures, fences, and horses. I'd ride over the farm itself and then up a hill north of the property. From that vantage, I could see much of the valley. I was on one of those high trails in a canyon when I noticed activity on the face of the hill. A group of coyotes was frantically darting in and out of the brush. When I got closer, I saw that they had a deer down and were in a feeding frenzy, ripping at her hide with their sharpened scissors. I ran at them with Johnny Tivio and used a rope I happened to have on the saddle to drive them off. The coyotes ran to a higher position on the hill before turning to look back. I chased them further still before returning to have a look at the deer. She was an old doe, thin and toothless, and probably only half her normal body weight. She had severe lacerations from the coyotes' attack. Scouting around for offspring, I spotted 2 half-grown fawns, obviously hers. I hoped they would fare all right. They were old enough to survive once they found their way back to the herd. The task now was to save the life of this old doe. I cantered down the hill to the shop area where I got my pickup truck, woven fencing, and steel posts. With several farmhands, I drove as close as I could to the doe. The coyotes, meanwhile, had inched back down the hill toward her. I started up the hill yelling at them, rope in hand and slapping my leg to divert their attention from the doe while the farmhands unloaded the fencing and posts. Eventually, the three of us built a coyote-proof cage over the doe about 15 feet in diameter and closed at the top. I put some grain and alfalfa hay in there and a bucket of water. As we worked around her, the weak doe struggled vainly to rise. I was certain that she would be dead the next day, but I had to give her a chance. When I arrived the following morning, she was up on her keel and had eaten and taken some water. This itself was amazing. Wild deer rarely allow themselves to eat or drink in captivity. I disturbed her as little as possible, and for the next 4 or 5 days I returned only long enough to ensure that she had food and water. By the fifth day, she was standing and taking a few steps around her enclosure. Fortunately, she lacked enough strength to run at the fencing and bash into it as a healthy wild deer would. Before she recovered and began doing just that, I decided the best course of action was to try to accustom her to my presence so she would not panic at the sight of me. I started by entering the cage, bending over and working gently with her, making the same subtle and non-threatening movements I used in starting horses. Amazingly, I was to find that the two languages are almost identical. Saving the Doe launched me on an adventure that has spanned nearly 20 years. It's been one of the most gratifying experiences of my life. Grandma, as I called her, was only 2 or 3 weeks in the cage before she was strong enough to take a chance on going outside. When I opened the cage, she walked off in that stately fashion the deer have. But you could tell she had no desire to put much distance between herself and me. Next morning, I found her 100 yards or so away from the cage. I put more grain and alfalfa inside and fashioned a watering device. Each day I worked with her, using the concepts of advance and retreat. Whenever she acted as though she preferred not to be with me, I deliberately push her away and walk behind her for up to 3 miles. When I saw her circling and showing me her flanks, thinking about renegotiating with me, I turn and walk away in the opposite direction. I was squaring up, looking her in the eye, driving her away, then dropping off and turning from her, just as I did with horses. I could coax her back